and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the entry of former Texas Governor Rick Perry into the crowded Republican presidential race. He managed to crash and burn in his last attempt at running in the 2012 campaign, where he famously could not remember which government program he wanted to cut. National radio commentator, writer, and public speaker Jim Hightower, who was twice elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner and is the author of Thieves in High Places, They've Stolen Our Country and It's Time to Take It Back, joins us to discuss whether there will be another oops moment for Rick Perry this next time around. Then we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, and speak with Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project and host of Strategy Session on KPFK in Los Angeles. He joins us for an update on the economic conditions in the oil-rich country, where the local currency, the bolivar, just 1 month ago was worth 279 bolivars to the dollar, but today is 408 bolivars to the dollar. We will discuss the upcoming elections and whether life in a country where gasoline is free, along with healthcare and education, is as bad as most American news coverage would suggest. Then finally, we'll examine the volatile situation in Burundi, where there has been unrest, violence, and a coup attempt since the president decided to ignore the constitution and extend his tenure for a third term. Elizabeth McClintock, who was recently part of a six-month conflict resolution training program for the Burundian National Commission on Demobilization and Reintegration, joins us to discuss protests that are largely driven by political outrage and are not a revival of ethnic tensions. And joining us now is Jim Hightower, who's a national radio commentator, writer, and public speaker. Twice elected as Texas Agriculture Commissioner, he is the New York Times bestselling author of seven books, including Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, and Thieves in High Places, They've Stolen Our Country and It's Time to Take It Back. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Hightower.
Oh, great to be with you, Ian, and on background.
Well, we're actually on the record here.
Well,
live. And of course, we're talking about this clown car parade that's going on, known as the Republican presidential primary, this crowded field into which Rick Perry has thrown his hat for the second time, in spite of the political disaster that happened in the last time he ran. So what is this, some kind of addiction Republicans that these politicians have?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, like the Huckabees are just trying to, up their fees and get another book contract or back on Fox TV at a higher salary. So a little bit of that going on. And then you've got the Donnie Trumps, who just can't seem to pass up either a mirror or a TV camera. So constantly in the race. But now we got the people that I had forgotten about, like George Pataki from New York and, all these. And here comes Perry, a guy, this is a fellow who really puts the goober in gubernatorial, in his years here in Texas, and in his last campaign, he ran around saying, my God, I've created all these jobs. Look at the jobs, look at the Texas miracle, million jobs I created. Well, what he didn't say is that they're not jobs, they're jobettes. They're low wage, no benefit, no job security attached for them, to them. And in fact, under Perry, in his 14 years as governor, Texas created more minimum wage jobs than every other state in the union combined. So, the question is not jobs. The question is upward mobility possibilities, and the question is income. You could go to a waitress here in Austin, where I am, tonight, and say, did you know Rick Perry created a million jobs while he was governor? And she'd say, yeah, I know. I've got three of them.
Well, in terms of where you are in Travis County, of course, a grand jury in Austin indicted Perry in August on two felony counts for abusing his official capacity, coercing a Democratic district attorney to step down by threatening to cut off state financing into an anti-corruption unit in her office. He nevertheless dodged that bullet, didn't he?
Well, no, not yet.
Really?
He's tried everything, politicians travel with entourages these days, presidential candidates do, but very few have five or six lawyers traveling with them, which Perry has. He hired some of the most expensive lawyers in Texas and a couple out of state, I think, to try to throw this thing out, and he's been trying that for months, and he's not gotten away with it. And by the way, the prosecutor was a Republican prosecutor, not a Democratic prosecutor, who brought this charge, these charges against him. So he's got a pretty big hickey out there. And then he's, you know, Ian, he's got this other problem, which he's not even the only Texan in the race, and he might not be the craziest Texan in the race. Now, imagine that.
Well, you know, Texas legislature just passed two laws, one that allows students in universities, public-funded universities, to carry firearms into classrooms and for open carry across the state. Pretty bizarre.
Well, I mean, after all, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, they do so well with beer. I mean, why not give them some guns?
to shoot the beer cans, or in this case, shoot the professor if he gives you a bad grade, right?
There you go. No, I mean, you know, you just can't make this stuff up. You know, it is it is beyond lunacy. And, you know, Texas is not alone in that. You know, we've got Snyder up in Michigan and Rick Scott down in Florida and Scott Walker in Wisconsin. And, you know, on and on. They seem to be in some sort of a, as you indicated earlier, sort of a clown car contest of who can be the goofiest.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Hightower, a veteran national radio commentator, writer, and public speaker who was twice elected as Texas Agriculture Commissioner. He's a New York Times bestselling author of seven books, including Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, and Thieves in High Places. They've stolen our country, and it's time to take it back. So if Rick Perry is spending a ton of money on lawyers and has been dodging this bullet for years now, apparently his biggest donor has been the billionaire Harold Simmons. Is he still pretty much on Simmons' payroll?
Well, Simmons died on him.
Oh, really?
I'm sorry. So did his second largest donor, Bob Perry, a right-wing housing developer out of Houston. And Perry died on him. Bob Perry rather than Rick. They're not related. So his two fat cat donors from his previous presidential fiasco, Bob Perry and Harold Simmons, have perished from this earth. So Rick is out there, you know, butt naked and butt ugly right now, kind of on his own. I thought it was interesting that he announced his candidacy without actually making a physical presence anywhere, presumably, so he couldn't be asked about such things.
Well, apparently he showed up at a municipal airport in Addison, which is a northern suburb of Dallas. He announced it on his website.
The website, yeah.
But then did this sort of impromptu staging in front of an airplane saying, it's time, and I'm running for the presidency of the United States. And
well, you know, Perry and Ted Cruz and the whole gang down here of right-wing goofballs who are running our state now, they keep, you know, rushing down to defend the United States at the Mexican border. But, you know, the other 49 states are wanting to move the U.S. border up to the Red River, the northern part of our state, and cede Texas to Mexico. But I'm not sure Mexico would be buying that.
Well, apparently there's a video of Perry strutting on stage to a song, which is a new version of the original chorus of Answer to No One. It features sort of rap verses about the right to own arms and closing the America's borders. So this seems to be a peculiar obsession with Texas politicians nowadays. They don't, their legislature meets and all they deal with are guns and abortion and
right, and the border, yeah. So
The border. So that's it.
That's one thing if you're running for governor of Texas, but it's another thing if you're running for president of the United States. You know, because folks in New Hampshire, folks in Iowa, folks out in the Colorado Rockies, you know, they're not real obsessed with the border. There's a tiny minority that are, but the rank and file voter is not. So these candidates who prance along the border, and nobody prances higher than Perry, you know, they're completely out of step with the rest of the country. I think most people are going to look at that and say, what the hell is he talking about?
So this song that he's got, this is a new version of Colt Ford's Country Hit Answer to No One. Apparently, it's making the rounds. I'll just read you the lyrics. Rick Perry supporters, let's protect our border, the song begins. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Rick Perry all the way. And the second verse says, give me my right to vote, my right to tote, the weapon of my choice. Don't censor my voice.
I thought he said the right to toke.
Now, that would be in California.
Yeah.
or Colorado, I guess.
Yeah, he's got to run in Colorado.
Right.
Maybe he should consider that. You know, well, that's the level of what our politics has become, and in the far right wing extremist nutball case, which Perry fits into very comfortably, it is. You know, just very, very strange and out of touch with the real needs of Americans who are looking at, you know, income inequality, unaffordability of college, jobs with real wages, you know, et cetera.
But why this paranoia? We had that whole thing about Jade Helm 15, the military exercise that Governor Abbott sicked the Texas Guard onto. And you've got in this rap song that's Perry's new anthem for his second presidential run, it's talking about, give me my right to vote. Well, the only people whose right to vote have been taken away are minorities, not white
Bingo.
People. And nobody's taking away anybody's weapons, and nobody's censoring anybody's voice. So where does it come from?
I think it's an insecurity on the part of the politicians. Well, I really think what it is, it's just rank political opportunism. They see some people, again, a small minority of people, who are upset for a lot of reasons, mostly the reasons that the Perrys are and Cruises and the Jeb Bushes and the Scott Walkers are not going to deal with, which is the destruction of the middle class in this country. And they see not only have they been knocked down, but they see that their children's future is no longer bright at all. So they're very anxious. And so rather than deal with the real problems that these folks are facing and working with those people to try to build something, not to take America back, as Perry and the Tea Party guys always like to shout at the top of their lungs, you know, but to move America forward so that everybody goes forward, you know, not just those with platinum cards and limousines, but everybody moves forward. Well, they're not going to do that. So what they're doing instead is trying to exploit the anxiety, the legitimate anxiety of rank-and-file people in our country, and twist it around to, you know, your problem are those, you know, black people who are trying to sneak in and vote, or your problem are those people coming across the border and from Mexico, those your problem are, you know, blah, 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 and just, you know, really trying to manipulate politics for their advantage. But I don't think it works anymore. You know, Perry is making the classic mistake, which is he's running his last campaign rather than this new campaign.
Well, Jim Hightower, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate
your
time.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Hightower, who's a national radio commentator, writer, and public speaker, twice elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner. He is a New York Times bestselling author of 7 books, including Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, and Thieves in High Places. They've stolen our country, and it's time to take it back. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Caracas, Venezuela.
Think you're in control. Well, I think está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas bien.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Antonio Gonzalez, who's president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voting participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, which during Gonzalez's tenure has nearly tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants today. He currently appears as a regular commentator on the Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio program here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. Time magazine named Gonzalez one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America, and he joins us from Caracas, Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonio Gonzalez.
Hi, and it's a pleasure to be with you today.
And you've actually been there recently because we spoke a while back, and my understanding is now that the bolivar, the currency, is worth less than a penny, and just a month ago it was 279 bolivars to the dollar, and now it's about 408 bolivars to the dollar. Is that, are you experiencing that in terms of the money in your wallet?
Well, you know, as a traveler with access to dollars, you know, my purchasing power has only gone up every time I come to Venezuela. Over the last 2 years, the inflation has been significant. Yeah, I think on the street is up above 400, but you can't get that price unless you're really, you know, tied into certain networks. The exchange rate for, in effect, a tourist like me is probably closer to 200. If I go out on the black market, I could probably get 300 for a bolivar. And remember, there's three different rates, so that the working-class Venezuelan gets a highly subsidized rate, and the basic basket of goods is actually quite inexpensive. So the government is subsidizes a lot of different kinds of consumption, and I imagine that they'll continue to do that as they essentially wait for elections in December, and also as they wait for the inevitable pressure on oil to push the price per barrel up. It's back up over $62 per barrel after being down in the 40s for some time, which was really devastating. That was the real crunch to the economy. Now it's begun to rise. There is some relief in sight, but I think Venezuela's in for another tough year with this inflation crisis. It really hurts on imported goods like toilet paper and baby diapers and certain food items that are imported. That's where it hurts, and really outside of Caracas. Inside of Caracas, you can pretty much, it's a big city. You can get stuff, wheel and deal your way to get stuff. But outside Caracas, it's tougher.
But is this leading to a growing divide there between Venezuelans who can pay to exchange bolivars for dollars and those who can't?
Yes and no. I mean, there's always been Venezuela is a very class divided society. The middle class and affluent sectors have been against the revolution for a long time. They're very consistent. Critical voting bloc and organized population against the programs of the revolution, and then the majority of lower middle class, working class, farmer, peasant Venezuelans are, continue to be, if frustratingly, in favor of the revolution's programs, but they've never had real big access to the dollar. Venezuela doesn't have a big exile community in the United States, so the the dollar economy is a limited economy in Venezuela. And again, I predict there'll be a devaluation here, but after the elections. And the government will begin to, you know, they subsidize, base gasoline is free. The basic food basket, you're talking about a few dollars for the average Venezuelan. An unemployed housewife gets a Social Security pension, right? Housework is paid in Venezuela. If you don't have another job, you get a check. And I think these ultimately these kind of programs will have to be adjusted to correspond with the reality of the economy, but not anytime soon.
So since the government has to import these consumer goods and is finding it more and more difficult to pay for them, my understanding is that now that Uruguay is doing a barter where they're swapping beef for Venezuelan oil, and Trinidad and Tobago apparently are offering toilet paper in exchange for Venezuelan oil. So I guess...
That's right. And there's a lot of that going on. You know, Venezuela has... they have a lot of sympathy in the international community because they've been so generous with their oil to Latin American countries and other what they call the countries that are in the south. That's how they refer to it here. There's the north and there's the south. So there's a lot of goodwill. They've been able to get some big investment and loans from China and Russia. And they have these countries, probably 30 countries, that they've been doing generous oil concessions to because they have the biggest oil reserves in the world. And now they're getting the good fortune return with countries providing, instead of cash, might provide, Dominican beans or Uruguayan beef or Nicaraguan beef back to Venezuela in their time of shortages, which was actually, it wasn't anticipated, but that was part of the arrangements. As you can tell, I'm out in the street here in Caracas. That was part of the oil deal arrangements, partnerships that have been going on for some 10 years. And they sure are timely. Let me tell you, they sure are timely for Venezuelans.
Well, one of the things that's extraordinary and somewhat ironic, Antonio Gonzalez, is that the big American companies in Venezuela are really losing hundreds of millions of dollars. That's Coca-Cola, American Airlines, even Disney. Oracle lost $111 million in its fiscal year last year, and Ford lost $800 million last year. But they're still staying in there, aren't they, the American companies?
Well, Venezuela is a half-trillion-dollar economy, and it's got abundant natural resources, not only oil, but gas and minerals, fertile land. It's a pretty sophisticated, compared to the rest of Latin America, it's pretty educated, sophisticated workforce and population. So, if you have a medium and long-term perspective, you just tolerate the ups and downs of the economies, like other oil economies in the developing world, or sort of natural product, raw minerals exporting countries. It has its ups and downs, and we're in a down cycle here. Now, it's important to note, though, when the United States was in its crisis, Venezuela did pretty well, because it's not tied so much to the U.S. and Western European economies. But now it's in a down cycle, and it's got – these are real structural problems. Dependency on an oil economy, which is – it's great and it's terrible, right? It's got its pros and cons. And also, during the Chavez regime, the president died 2 years ago, he invested a lot in human, social infrastructure, but he didn't invest a lot in the economic infrastructure. So they're paying that price. I mean, they did a lot in education, a lot in healthcare, a lot in that kind of development, a lot in subsidizing consumption for the poor. But that money came from somewhere. So it didn't go into, roads and bridges and electrical and water infrastructure, oil, increasing oil production investment. And so I think, again, probably after the elections, there'll be an adjustment in terms of rechanneling some of the productivity of the economy and some of the subsidies to popular consumption into more middle and long-term investment. And it is needed. But Venezuela's got, just like American politics, there are things done in election years, things not done in election years, same thing in Venezuela.
So we've heard reports that the sky is falling for some time now, and you're there on the street, and I take it it's not falling. Somehow people are muddling through?
Yeah, that's right. Venezuela is essentially, comparatively speaking, it's not like a Mexico scenario where there's a sort of a drug war going on where dead bodies are, piling up. Venezuela has a crime problem, but it's not in any way, shape, or form with a civil war or a nascent civil war. There is a robust electoral system here. People fight it out. Elections are the national pastime, sort of like sports, and they'll fight it out again in December. Probably the elections are going to be called for December. These are congressional elections. And there's vigorous civic activity, a lot of criticism on TV, a lot of debate. And, that's going to continue. You ask people, they'll tell you, they hate the government, or, they love the government. It is divided and has been. As long as I've been coming here, it has been. But life goes on. People go to school. People go to work. People find a way to survive. And some sectors progress. Some sectors are hurt. But certainly I don't feel at all any kind of social crisis like what you see. And you see that in some media outlets that are really concerned about inflation. And I think it's a very serious problem. Don't get me wrong. But it is not, the people that I see are getting by. And, we'll just have to keep following it. There is a government response. They are making some adjustments. And the price of oil is going up, and they've gotten some international aid, and I think essentially to get through the balance of the year, and then there'll be a new correlation of forces based on the elections, and then there'll be some adjustments, I think.
So in terms of the foreign debt payment, the $5 billion that the government owes that's due in October, there are reports in the financial pages here in the United States that the Venezuela may not be able to make that payment. It doesn't sound like, from your perspective, that things are quite that dire.
Well, they always say that. And you pay your debt in May and in October, April, May, and October. And there was that same report saying, April, May, Venezuela is going to default. And they paid their debt. They paid every year. They're pretty good about macroeconomic stuff compared to, for example, the bad boy, which is Argentina, which is they're always not paying and defaulting. Venezuela's had a pretty good macroeconomic track record of paying their debt on time. And I have heard, it's going to be terrible in October because we have to pay, but we're going to pay. And I think that's right. I think that's on point. It would be tough. There'll be belt tightening, probably some, stuff that won't get paid domestically in October, but the international obligations will be respected.
So what is then the explanation, which obviously many people ask this question, with all of that, those rich resources that you mentioned earlier, with the world's largest reserves of oil, even though the price has gone down, it's still a extraordinarily much in demand. Why is there such, economic distress? I know there is, you mentioned it earlier, this notion of a resource curse, that oil has both a blessing and a curse. But still, that question does arise, how come?
Venezuela, and there is a revolution going on here. I like to think of it as a comparatively peaceful, slow-motion revolution. It's not at all like the model that during my generation saw Marxist revolutionaries seizing the state, destroying it, and then building it anew with revolutionary characteristics. That's not the model in Venezuela or in South America, for that matter, where you have probably socialist governments in like a dozen different countries, governments that say they're for socialism. And so there's a transition going on. But that makes it complicated. So think of it like, three-dimensional chess. This transition includes generous investment, social investment programs. Economists might call them subsidies, where, you know, adults go to school for free. There's free, heavily subsidized healthcare programs with little healthcare offices in every neighborhood, heavily influenced by the Cuban model. There's subsidies for foodstuffs. Gasoline is basically free. Think about this. A bolivar is $400, 400 bolivars to the dollar. Gas costs like 2 bolivars a gallon. It's free.
Wow.
So there's this generous social spending on the one hand, right, and a generous foreign aid program to countries, particularly the Caribbean Basin countries that have a lower standard of living than Venezuela, where they're helping to develop. You basically give oil to countries for half price, and then the other half of the oil that they get, they get half of the oil free, and they use the profits from those sales, because they sell it, to generate economic development, like put up factories and things like that. And I've seen this with my own eyes. It's called Petrocaribe, and they're building factories and increasing grain and cattle production in all these other countries. So there is a revolutionary program, which, by the way, is very democratic, with even more elections than we have in the United States that are highly participated in. And a really pissed off private sector, which hates all this and acts politically.
Right.
Part of the crisis in Venezuela is the resistance of the private sector, which is a healthy private sector. It's not a small private sector. It's a healthy private sector. They're losing profits. They're not happy about it. Some of them do economic sabotage or break laws, and they get nationalized. The private sector is probably shrinking, but it's not disappearing. And it's not the policy of the government at this time to disappear the private sector. So it's, and then the price of oil dropped. The budget was set at 60 or 80 dollars a barrel, and then the price of oil dropped to 36 at one point. So it's a three-dimensional chess game. And then Chavez dies, and a government that was unprepared for his death takes power. Chavez was the great unifier, and people agreed with stuff that he wanted to do that don't agree with Maduro, the new president, but he's basically doing the same things that Chavez did.
Mm-hmm.
So politically divided,
right,
and buffeted by both world, global economic forces, plus the, some would say, not very pragmatic, generous social programs of the revolution. You put that together, and at least as long as oil is down, causes an economic, it doesn't look like a crisis, but I guess an economist would say, yeah, it's a crisis.
Right, but for an American audience, the fact that you get gasoline for less than a penny a gallon, you get free education and free health care, that does leave us with something to think about when we criticize other countries, because...
At least at this point, a critical mass of Venezuelans love it.
Yeah, well, I think the majority of Americans would love it, too, if they had it,
Yeah. Right,
so.
Right. A critical mass of Venezuelans still support this revolutionary process, but it is shrinking because just people are frustrated. If you can't get toilet paper, you'd be mad. And yeah. I get that, right? Or somebody gets mugged and the police are unable to arrest the guy. That will make you mad. And I get that. You have to have effective government service And this is not unusual, Ian. The revolutionaries are good at winning elections or gaining power, but they often, for real pragmatic reasons, aren't good at governance. Here, for example, most of the effective old government functionaries, they left office. They're not going to work for the revolution. So you have a shortage of skilled bureaucrats. The governing class is unskilled. And we've seen that in revolution after revolution, where, you know, you can win power, but you're lousy at governing. And there's some of that going on in Venezuela as well. But although the Venezuelans, I've always been impressed by their ability to, like, learn.
Well, Antonio,
make mistakes and finally get it right.
Well, meanwhile, our politicians dig the hole deeper. I thank you very much for joining us, Antonio Gonzalez.
It's always a pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, who's president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voting participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Progress, which during Gonzalez's tenure has nearly tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million today. He currently appears as a regular commentator on the Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. And he joined us from Caracas, Venezuela. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the volatile situation in Burundi. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth McClintock, who is a managing partner at CM Partners, who was recently part of a six-month conflict resolution training program for the Burundian National Commission on Demobilization and Reintegration, and has acted as a consultant to the Burundian government and co-facilitated a two-year USAID-funded program to develop a conflict resolution curriculum for Burundian high schools. Her ongoing work at the World Health Organization focuses on improving the ability of member states to better manage the global health diplomacy process, and she is the co-author of Negotiating Public Health in a Globalized World, Global Health Diplomacy in Action. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth McClintock.
Thank you for having me.
And there's been a crisis brewing in Burundi for some time, and it clearly doesn't get a lot of attention in the global media. But it does seem that this crisis has been provoked by President Pierre Nkurunziza, who has decided he wants to run for a third term. But now, because of international pressure from both Europe and Africa, he has postponed the elections that were supposed to be held on June the 26th to August the 26th. So is this going to diffuse the situation, or are we going to have extra months of unrest?
I think that's a great question, Ian. I think that there is an opportunity for that decision to contribute to diffusing the crisis. At the moment, certainly the conditions for free, transparent, and credible elections don't exist. So the decision to postpone the elections from that perspective is certainly a good one. And I think it would be a really wonderful opportunity for opposition parties, should those conditions be created, of course. It would be a great opportunity for opposition parties to begin to focus on their own platforms and on the issues really facing Burundians, as opposed to being focused on whether or not the president should run for a third term, which has sort of pushed every other issue off the table. So there could be some very positive outcomes of postponing the elections.
But the most prominent opposition candidate, Agathon Rwasa of the National Forces of Liberation, has boycotted the elections.
He has. He boycotted them when they were scheduled for June, and I think that there is a possibility that that might change. I think that should the international community, and particularly I think the EAC and the African Union, continue to engage the government in dialogue about what needs to happen to create conditions for free and fair elections, that those decisions of opposition parties, which made sense, you know, even a day ago, might actually be changed. They might change their minds about whether or not they want to participate.
Well, the opposition leader, of course, made that statement following the May 23rd killing of the opposition leader, Zedi Feruzi, who was killed in a drive-by shooting. So that, again, leads one to question the environment for a democratic election.
Oh, I don't think one exists now. My statements very much are hinge upon being able to create those free and fair conditions. So I would agree with you that were the elections held tomorrow or later this month, every candidate in the ruling party would have every reason to not participate because those conditions don't exist. However, with help from the AU, the EAC, from the international community, should those conditions be created, I do think that there could be a very different way to ease the tensions and perhaps set Burundi on a more constructive path towards its democratic future.
And, of course, Burundi being next door to Rwanda, is the assumption has been in a lot of the reporting that, oh, this is just a resumption of ethnic struggles. But it seems to be more local. It seems to be more about a blatant political power grab. And it also seems to be largely, correct me if I'm wrong, this is a struggle between the elites as opposed to the people in the hills.
Well, definitely for the latter part of your question, I absolutely agree. I think given the nature of Burundi, it's largely subsistence farmers, upwards of 90%. So it's one of the poorest countries in the world, and last year was rated as the hungriest country in the world. And quite frankly, many of those people have not, they literally can't afford to join something like a protest, so the contest for political power does happen amongst the elite. And frankly, that is traditional in Burundi. The population is often left to the side. And it's really only in 1993 that they had the first time to participate massively in elections, and then with the assassination of the president, went to civil war. So it's they have not had many opportunities to exercise their sort of their political rights. Now, I would say that while Rwanda experienced massive, of course, violence in 1994 with a genocide, Burundi has experienced massive violence over the course of its history as well. And there are reasons to be fearful that there might be an uptick, a serious uptick in violence. On the other hand, it seems to me that at this point, there has actually been more restraint exercised than I would have anticipated at first. To be quite honest, when announcements of the protests against the third mandate were first made, I was quite fearful that there might be a very serious government crackdown on the protesters, and was relieved to see that the protesters were able to continue to protest, at least for some time, with very little violence. Now the situation has changed in the aftermath of the coup, and I think the fear of violence has again risen. It is a very fragile situation in Burundi, and I think there's a lot of reason to be fearful that the violence might increase. As you say, though, this is really not so much an ethnic issue at all. It's really it's a political issue. It's a political crisis and needs to be resolved, I believe, through political dialogue.
But it does seem, though, that the president is using the fact that there was an attempted coup by a major general, Niyombare, who was a former ally of the president. And this coup attempt took place, about a month ago. Apparently, in terms of cracking down on the opposition, they're essentially blaming them for being pushed, they're using the word pushed, and suggesting that people with legitimate objections to a third term are all somehow associated with this failed coup by a military general.
Yes, so I think that is the tragedy of the failed coup. The military, up until that point, had played a reasonably constructive role in maintaining the peace and keeping the protesters separate from the police, and that was incredibly constructive and I think went a long way towards minimizing violence. And with the attempted coup, it exposed the very fragile nature of unity within the army, and it forced people to take sides in ways in which they hadn't had to before, those within the army. And that just meant that when the president reappeared, exactly, he is able to associate those who have a legitimate right to protest against the third term, who might disagree with the interpretation of the Constitution that the president says ostensibly allows him to run for a third term, and they may feel very differently, and they have a right to protest. Now suddenly they're all lumped into the same category. So it's quite convenient for the president and the government to be able to put them all in the same category, and it's disappointing because I do think that they're two very separate events. Perhaps one encouraged by the other, the coup takers, perhaps they were encouraged by the protesters, I don't know, but I do not believe that the protesters are necessarily for the coup d'etat. Many people did not feel that power should be, you know, usurped that way. They're not in favor of a military takeover. So that's really changed the equation for many, many, mostly young people who are protesters, because now they really risk being victims of the intelligence services or being sought out as sort of attempted coup members, and that's not at all what they had intended initially, is my understanding.
But since this failed coup on May the 13th, clearly the government has used that as an opportunity to crack down on protests, and this includes journalists, human rights activists, anybody that there's still a few people braving it, apparently, holding up signs against the third mandate, but they're getting thinned out. And my understanding is about 100,000 people have fled the country?
That's correct. Over 100,000 people have fled the country, and in part, this is due to Burundi's history, where, you know, major political crises prompted massive repression. So people have what started the sort of, if you will, the wave of the exodus from Burundi was really in anticipation of a violent crackdown that did not happen yet. There is still the lack, you mentioned the media, the lack of information that's available to Burundians only heightens their fear. So therefore, in the absence of information and seeing a situation of a political crisis that could at any moment in the view of, you know, your average Burundian spill over, they are taking the preemptive decision to leave the country, because they do not want to have experienced what they lived through for 13 years, you know, massive violence, civil war, et cetera. So the exodus is really driven by the inability of the government to effectively manage a political crisis, a fear that political crisis will result in mass violence, and a lack of information due to the shutdown of media.
And Elizabeth McClintock, while this is not turned into an ethnic struggle or a revival of ethnic tensions, apparently in terms of the rhetoric that's being used to mobilize the Imbonerakure, mm-hmm. the youth wing of the ruling party, it's apparently very much tinged with ethnic hatred. So give us a sense of these paramilitaries, these youth wings of the party. You mentioned the struggle between the divisions between the police and the military. How many are they militias? What's the landscape here?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. Of course, the government would say there are no militias, and frankly, the opposition parties would say they don't have militias either. Yet, instead, they simply have very active youth members who form these youth wings of the parties, much like the Young Republicans at a university, for example, they might say, when in fact there is good data to support the fact that these youth movements are often, they have a much more of a militia-like character, meaning that they receive weapons. It's unclear from whom, although there are accusations that the government is distributing weapons, and then there are accusations that some of the opposition parties are also acquiring and distributing weapons to their youth wings. There is also a suspicion that the former military structure before the CNDD-FDD became an official political party, of course it was a rebel group, and that former structure of the rebel army is being replicated in the Imbonerakure. And that is what is of great cause for concern, because it implies that there is much more planning and structure to these groups than simply, you know, young people getting together because they're angry or they want to support the president, et cetera. And so that militia-type character then has also instilled a lot of fear, as much by the rumor of its existence as by its actual existence and intimidation that does happen by members of the Imbonerakure and other groups in the interior of the country, which is where they are most active. So it's very concerning, because it is not clear who controls these groups and if they would actually respond to a call to stand down, as it were, if some conclusion to the political crisis was reached. It isn't clear to whom these groups are accountable, and that raises fears, and frankly, it raises the level of violence quite a lot.
But what's happening because of President Pierre Nkurunziza's power grab, if you will, for a third term? Isn't this very similar to what happened right next door in the Congo with Kabila in 2016 and Rwanda with Kagame in 2017?
In other words, they are planning to run for third terms or additional terms beyond their mandates. Yes, and not uncommon. I mean, frankly, in Uganda, Museveni has been president for many, many years. So it's not unlike many leaders in around the developing world. I don't think it's restricted to Africa by any means, where there is a perception that some aspects of democratic institutions, such as term limits, are perhaps less applicable in given context. And there are other parts of the democratic process, such as elections for parliamentarians, et cetera, that are more familiar to what we know in our own context, our own democracies. I think that's why it's challenging for the African Union and even the East African community to generate enough momentum to, for example, come out strongly in favor of a more balanced ruling from the constitutional court in Burundi, for example, and without pressure and without intimidation of the judges on the constitutional court. You don't hear much from the East African community members, because there are other leaders in the region who might themselves be considering a run for another term beyond what their current mandate would allow.
Well, I just mentioned two, and their neighbors, Kabila, exactly. who faces a constitutional ban on continuing in power in 2016, and Kagame in Rwanda.
Kabila. Precisely. Yeah. But that's why you don't hear from the East African community. They are members of the East African community.
Sure.
So there is a somewhat of a synergy there.
Right. And of course, this is all out of Vladimir Putin's playbook. So it's not restricted to Africa.
By any means.
So just in closing then, tell us about Burundi's a country that half of its budget comes from external foreign aid. And Belgium has threatened to cut off all foreign aid to the country. So what kind of leverage do they have? And I suspect, since apparently it was pressure from Europe and from African leaders that brought about this announcement that the elections are going to be put off until August the 26th. So what kind of leverage do they have?
Well, on the one hand, I think certainly the international community has a lot of leverage. On the other hand, given that Burundi is a sovereign state, as much as the international community would like to influence the decisions taken by the Burundian government, or frankly any government for that matter, with which they're unhappy, there is a limit to what they can do, short of violence happening and making a choice to have an armed intervention from sort of a peacekeeping force. So I think the challenge is that there is good data to support the fact that tying aid to decisions on the part of a government also doesn't always work. Peter Juven wrote an excellent book on this, Aiding Violence, about what might have led up to the genocide in Rwanda, on the part of the activities of the international community. And I think in Burundi, international community is trying to be much more conscious of not completely withdrawing, because leaving the government on its own leaves us no opportunity to influence change. So choosing to simply withdraw all aid won't give us then any other leverage. So what happens next? So I think it's important that the international community keep in mind that, in fact, we shouldn't be running away from Burundi. In my view, we should be approaching Burundi and trying to really put the pressure on for dialogue. And maybe that sounds sort of like an oxymoron, pressure for dialogue. But indeed, I think we need to do everything possible to encourage dialogue at all levels in Burundian society, amongst the elite, to deal with the immediate political crisis and its future, you know, amongst decision influencers to reduce and end violence and intimidation that's done, for example, by the Imbonerakure and other opposition youth militias, and at the community level. And the challenge is when violence goes, you know, increases, as internationals, we have a tendency to withdraw our staff and sort of try to use more blunt instruments such as sanctions or withdrawing our aid, when in fact we need more nuanced approaches and we need to actually be doubling down and really trying to find any avenues possible to engage dialogue and influence the government.
Well, Elizabeth McClintock, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth McClintock, who's a managing partner at CM Partners, who was recently part of a 6-month conflict resolution training program for the Burundian National Commission on Demobilization and Reintegration. And she has acted as a consultant to the Burundian government and co-facilitated a 2-year USAID-funded program to develop a conflict resolution curriculum for Burundian high schools. Her ongoing work for the World Health Organization focuses on improving the ability of member states to better manage the global health diplomacy process. And she is the co-author of Negotiating Public Health in a Globalized World, Global Health Diplomacy in Action. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.